Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs in Schools.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us.
He was trying to brand us. So we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
Join my hosts as they unravel the story of the largest and most shocking organization in the history of the troubled teen industry. Listen to season two of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, dude.
The 90s called.
With Christine Taylor and David Lasher.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Hey, Dude, the 90s called podcast. I'm David.
Hi, David. I'm Christine. How are you doing, Christine, in the Los Angeles rain?
I think it might finally be over, but it was 4 days straight of torrential. I've never seen anything like it.
We always get the news footage here of the worst of it. So it looked awful. It looked like there were cars flooded and mud everywhere, landslides. And yeah, it's LA just, it's never equipped for that kind of excessive rain for that long.
Well, we don't just get like normal rain, like in New York, where it rains for a day and it's kind of nice. It's like, it's going to be a 4 day, they were calling it, atmospheric river. Mm. It was all over the news. I was getting calls from everyone I knew around the world. Are you okay? And I was like, yeah, you know, right now, yeah, we're okay. Thank God we are. But yeah, there's homes that came off their foundations and mudslides and a lot of debris, but I think it finally is over.
You're in the, it does. I see some light coming through your window. So that's a good sign.
Yes.
Good sign. I have a great little story that, and I very quickly, because our guest is yes, she's okay, she's in the waiting room, and I love our guest today, and I really want to have a full hour with her. Very quickly, not this past Saturday, but the weekend before, on SNL, Dakota Johnson was hosting, and we were watching, you know, Ben and Quinn and I, and we are just such big, huge Mikey Day fans. Like, there's nothing he cannot do. He is funny in every single sketch, from the smallest little part to the, like, you know, he goes for it. I mean, we just love him. And so Ben, I guess, tweeted something. Do you even say that anymore? Since I'm not on, what do you
tweeted,
say? Do you still say tweeted?
Even though it's called X.
Anyway, Ben put out a tweet about how, and with a link to this sketch that we saw that we loved so much that we were just laughing so hard. And Mikey reached out to Ben to just say, that was like the greatest thing ever. Thank you so much. Aww. And he said, and by the way, I'm a huge fan of your wife's podcast with David Lasher.
Awesome.
He was like, I was in the Hey Dude pocket of right. I was he a Hey Dude was. Fan. And he is a listener. So I really, if he's listening to this episode, I just want to say what big fans we are. And it's always so fun when you hear about sketch? Someone.
What was the sketch? Because oh I gosh. Was cracking up at him last week, too.
This was the sketch where it's he and Dakota Johnson are playing the parents, the old parents, and they put in the videotape of how he's like, this is the, when we found out yes. how went, that we were going to have a baby, and it's them on like a Jerry Springer.
Yeah. Oh my God.
How brilliant was he in that sketch playing
he's
the,
great.
The, oh my God. It just, I just am laughing thinking about it. anyway,
thanks for sharing
anyway,
that. That's
yes,
awesome.
Yes. Yes. And thanks, Mikey. We're huge fans of yours. So thanks for listening. Anyway, all right, let's get to our guest. Let's just bring her in. She doesn't even need an introduction. Bonnie Hunt is epic and I love her. And
so excited.
Let's say hi. Bonnie Hunt.
Hi.
Welcome to our podcast.
I'm happy to be here with you guys.
You are so kind and generous. I sent you an email. Okay, first of all, let me go back to just how we met, because you worked with Ben on Dannemora, and we didn't meet during that period of time.
No, and I've known Ben since I was 20 years old.
That's it. And first of all, like, we've always been gigantic fans of yours. And so I remember when you like said yes to being in Escape at Dannemora, he was over the moon excited to be working with you. And you're so, so brilliant. But I had the great pleasure of sitting next to you at the Directors Guild Awards.
Yeah, DGA, yeah.
Yeah, which was almost a year ago. And you were nominated for the series Amber Brown. Ben was nominated. You both lost.
No, there's no losers. No,
but
come
we
on.
All went home with little director's chair tchotchkes. Oh.
Yes, with our
that I'm sure you keep displayed prominently.
Well, my niece loved hers because you know, it had her name on it.
And she was so cool. We just had the best night. You know how those dinners, those events can sometimes be a little bit anxiety provoking. Right. And
you know, Christine, with you too, I just felt like immediately at home, and just, you're great, you know, and funny and smart and kind. And it was just, it just made the evening, that's what the joy of the evening was.
So much.
Yeah, it really is. It's those relationships, those paths that cross. And it's just like, oh, this is nice.
Yeah. It was so, and I said, I'm getting your information and I'm literally going to make you be my best friend. I love you so much. And guess what? A year went by and then the first email you get from me is asking you to come on this podcast.
No,
shamelessly.
I'm happy to be here. David, where were you? What, David, have we ever met? Which is a terrible thing to say somebody, but it's my mind that sometimes.
Okay, so my roommate when I moved to LA was Doug Ellen.
Oh, do you know Doug? I did a movie with Doug.
Kissing a Fool, yes, with David Schwimmer. Christine, this was David's first movie on the heels of Friends, like when he was.
I remember the movie, yes, of course.
And I remember, I was with Doug the whole time, and Bonnie was so freaking funny in this movie. And I was always aware of you and I'm a huge fan of your work, but Kissing a Fool and your collaboration with Doug is the first time that I'm sure we were at the premiere or some screening together, but never really like met like this. So it's so nice to finally meet you.
Oh, that's nice. I remember Doug having a laptop on the set and we were quickly doing rewrites as we were going along. It was a nice collaboration. And then when I did a series, I think it was Life with Bonnie.
Right. You hired him, right?
Well, CBS made me hire writers, even though we had written all the episodes. And they just always did that to me. I would write everything and come in and sell it and be in production. They'd say, oh, you got to basically have some guys around you, I guess. And I hired each writer saying, I'm hiring you. But everything's kind of, you know, written. And then what's not written, I kind of change as I go along based on the actors I'm working with. Because if you get somebody great, you write a new episode for them. You know, like if an actor was available, like Tom Hanks or something, who we had, Tom Hanks, Robin Williams, all these guys, the Smothers Brothers did the show. So if they called me and said, hey, I have a week free, I'm like, okay, and write a new episode. But Doug was on that show and he wrote a couple of episodes just to, examples. And I said, I think you should be writing for like men. You
and look what happened.
I think you should write a movie.
The most masculine show in the history of television.
Yes. I said, take your time here. You have an office. You're being paid. Write something about guys because,
That is so great. Stuff,
you know, what he wrote was fine. It just wasn't for a woman, for me.
And, right. But Kissing a Fool took place in Chicago, right? And that... Christine, you can take it away, but like, I know you're, I want to hear about your roots in Chicago and Second City and all that.
Yeah, no, tell, you got to fill us in on everything. Yes.
Oh. Yes. Well, I grew up in Chicago, west of Wrigley Field, off of Addison. And, I had six brothers and sisters and still lucky that we're all here. We grew up in a little brick bungalow and had the best of times. We had the best neighborhood. We had one of those neighborhoods where all the kids were on their banana seat bikes. And
did you hear the Cubs games from your
family? No, we weren't that close. We weren't we were there all the time. I mean, Wrigley Field was one of the most romantic places in my life. Like it was where you went on first dates and where you went when you were a kid, you'd go with your folks and you'd see them happy and enjoying the game and relaxing. And just like sports, entertainment and what we do is so healing. I mean, I was a nurse in Chicago. I went to nursing school and became a nurse and was working full time as a nurse and then got hired by Second City after auditioning. So I would work as a nurse and, do 8 shows a week. And it was one of the greatest times in my life. And I knew it was because I was a cancer nurse. So I'd be all day with patients that could escape for a moment when they'd watch. I bring in a VCR, that's when we were doing VCRs and I'd movies and, just see the power of storytelling and how it can help somebody for a moment escape what might be scaring them or hurting them or making them sad.
Oh, I would. I mean, imagine having you as a nurse, because my mom went through cancer a couple of years ago, and it was the nurses that we formed the greatest bonds with. It was like, it was my mom, my mom knew their stories. If they had a great sense of humor, that was even better, but they were maternal and gentle. And I mean, really? That's the job.
It's an honor to be when somebody lets you in. I mean, I've been a volunteer patient advocate for newly diagnosed cancer patients now for 30 years. And it's a big part of my life. And every week I'm at the hospital with somebody and it's such a private, intimate journey for a family. And when you're a part of it, it's just something I have great respect for and that keeps my perspective and is a gift. It's the best part of life is that connection. And whether it's through what we do as storytellers or when you're holding somebody's hand, it's powerful and it's what it's all about. I mean, when you figure that out, everything gets a little more focused in the
right way. I see the path though, from nurse in a cancer unit to Second City. Now I can understand it because it really, the power of comedy or music or, when we're young, we don't really get it, but it really, it saves so many people and brings so much.
It's so true, David. And my mom raised us with that. I remember one time when one of our dogs died, my mom, she was a great musician, just played the piano beautifully, could play anything from the Rolling Stones to, Irving Berlin. And she would play a song and tell us to sing it. I remember crying so hard over the loss of our dog. And she said, just keep singing, sing the song as loud as you can. And my mom sang in the house all the time and played music all the time. And you're so right about the powerful healing of the arts. It's just, it's so important.
So important.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us. They burned us and subject us to really horrible, cruel and unusual punishment.
After my personal experience at Provo Canyon School, I was shocked to learn that a man named Robert Litchfield, a man who got his start at the school that I went to, would go on to create a multi-million dollar empire.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's in treatment.
The Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They prey on, you know, a parent's really natural and beautiful love for their children in a really, really, unfortunately, effective way.
At this time in my life now, if someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, sham, scam, beware.
Listen to season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s.
She looked like a million bucks.
With zero qualifications.
She had a Harvard plaque.
Tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. That this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As a kid, did you perform in school plays? Were you in the choir? Were you, did you, you know, were you a sort of, you know, artist in your sort of middle school, elementary, high school years, but then took the sort of practical path?
No, I was mostly an audience. I had six siblings who were all really funny, and my parents were fast. They were very witty, and their arguments were even, if they were scripted, they were gold mines, because they were just so... Humor saved us. It saved us from tough times financially, and emotionally tough times. And my parents gave us their gift. My dad died really young. He was 52. And my mom had seven kids. And her faith, her humor got us through it. And so I think that was just something I saw how powerful it was when my siblings would make my mom or dad laugh. And then you just start to see like, oh, you know, I want a little bit of that magic. And even watching my parents watch TV, which I've told the story a million times, that when I would see them watch like a show like the Andy Griffith Show or the Mary Tyler Moore Show or All in the Family and see them, or Carol Burnett, and just the calmness and the escape and the humor and the joy, you're looking at the TV, you're looking at your parents like, this is magic. This is better than any medicine.
Yeah, this is lighting them up in a way that I don't see in the day-to-day, right? It just is, right.
And we all to see that. You know, I volunteered in a hospital as a candy striper, and I got in the local newspaper because I had the most volunteer hours. And I loved being with the patients. I loved hearing their stories. I loved talking to them. I loved sharing my life with that. It was such a big part of my life that my dad's like, oh, you got to go to nursing school. You know, you're a natural. And
It was a calling. It was a calling.
Right. And it still is. It's still, you know, fully left.
Who was at Second City when you started there or during your time there? Because, I mean, the people that have come out of there are just, it's unreal.
Right? I mean, I was so lucky. And I was a fan. I mean, I was going there all the time as a young person. And then they had this audition. There was one position available for, you know, they only had at the time two women in every cast and I think four or five guys.
So you find out about this audition. And someone said you got to do this, or you were like, I'm going to do this. And what did you prepare? What was the process?
You can't prepare anything. You get on stage and they just start asking you questions.
Oh my gosh,
that's it. They don't want you to do anything. They don't want you to come in with.
You have to be sharp.
What, David?
You have to be sharp, right? That's what they're looking for.
Yeah, that was the thing. And I do remember like the first question they asked me is, what makes you think you're an improviser, a good improviser? And I said, well, I'm from a big Irish, Polish, Catholic family. And, you know, every Sunday morning, my mom was like, happy family, take one. And we'd leave that house and we'd go in car. We're happy and everything's fine. And, you know, you learn to be, you know, when one of the uncles was intoxicated, it was like he has an inner ear infection. You know, there was always some way to make everything look okay.
To think on your toes, right?
Yeah,
he's not in a blackout. His ear is bothering.
Yeah. Why did he park the car up on the curb? He has an ear infection.
Inner ear infection, of course.
There's always something. We always had stories for everything fast. And So I remember that, but it was like 200 girls showed up, over 200, and there was one spot available. So we had to come back every week and they kept eliminating people. So
200 girls for one spot?
It was over 200, I remember. Oh, and they just kept weeding them out. And I just did it just because I loved being at the theater. I was there every night. I would watch the improv sets were free. So I would go for the improv set and I admired everybody in the cast. It was Richard Kind, Dan Castellaneta, Mike Haggerty, the great late Jim Fay, Isabella Hoffman. It was the best and they were the best. And I just was in awe of them. So I was really, and then I was hired as the alternate. They hired another girl to get the spot and they hired me as the alternate. And then she started rehearsing with them and she wasn't really getting the scenes. And the director called me and said, how well do you know the show? And I said, I know it in my sleep. He's like, can you do it tonight in like 3 hours? I said, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was one of those showbiz moments, you know, like I was at the drugstore and the lead had twisted their ankle. You know, I was like, I'll go in.
And you just say yes without even missing a beat, right? This is an opportunity. I'm doing it. Come hell or high water.
Next woman up. Let's go.
Pretty great. Pretty great. Very, very lucky.
Oh, my gosh. So that was how long then in Second City? And that was while you were still nursing?
I was in a touring company first for a very short time, like 4 weeks before this phone call came to put me on main stage. And during that time, I took a leave from the hospital, but I was calling in every day. And then when I got on main stage, I was able to, I started working at the VA hospital. And I left Northwestern at that point and worked at the VA. And yeah, I worked, it was at Second City 3.5 years and did both for a long time. In fact, when I did my first TV series, when I got my first TV series, when it was canceled on NBC, I went back to Chicago, went back to my nursing job. Thinking, okay, that was, you know, great. But I did Rain Man. I got Rain Man during one of my lunch hour auditions from the hospital. I ran to this cattle call. And
okay.
Was your first acting job was Rain Man?
Yes. Richard Kind was in the cast with me, and I didn't have money to join the union. It was, I think it was like $2,000 or something. And he said, I'll give it to you, but you have to pay me back in one lump sum. So, can I give you $50 at a time? No. I want one lump sum. But Richard saved me a few times. He loaned me that money. And then I ended up, we were roommates when I first came to LA. So it was a whole other
experience. I had no idea. Richard was one of the first people I met when I moved to LA. David, it was when David was on the TV show Blossom, and I was a guest star on that show. And Richard was shooting. Was Richard on Herman's Head, or was
he? Oh yes,
Richard and George did a pilot for called the Bennett Brothers.
That's what it was. But Hank Azaria was on Herman. Like, it was all these people were shooting on the same lot.
And I remember,
yes. And my friend at the time was very close with Richard and Hank, and I just remember meeting all of these funny guys.
Yeah,
like. I was in LA for, I think, 2 months or something. And so Richard, I mean, I just feel like they are my people still to this day.
Cause we were all out here unknown, trying to make it. I officially moved in 1990.
Okay.
To LA, and, you know, it's just, I thought I came out here for 6 months. I gave myself 6 months and I have to go back to my nursing job. You know, but I had a great patient that said to me, because I used to bring the whole cast from Second City to the hospital, you know, and we would do the show there for my on my floor. And one of my patients, Rudy Dobrievich, said, "When are you going to go, you know, chase your dreams in Hollywood?" I said, "Rudy, I can't do that. It wasn't my late 20s, you know. I'm like, I can't. It's too late, you know. And then I'd fail, and I have to come back, and that would be." And he's like, "Take my hand and look me in the eye." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "You know, he's facing the end of his life, and." He said, "The biggest regret of my life is that I feared failure. So look me in the eye and shake my hand and tell me that when I'm gone, you'll go to California and you'll fail many times." He goes, "Do we have a deal?" And I said, "Yes, we have a deal." So, a really big, you know, he gave me all of that perspective.
That's
I failed many times. Wow. I failed many times. I fulfilled the promise.
Oh my gosh.
You would bring the cast of Second City into the hospital cancer unit to perform?
Yes. Mike Myers, Richard, Murray. Yeah, whoever would say yes. And everybody always said yes. Yeah.
How could you say no?
Yeah. But
I didn't even know that was allowed.
Neither was bringing in a VCR with videotapes. I did as well. With my whole life. I was single. I had a little apartment near the hospital, and it was my whole life. The patients were my whole life, and they gave me such meaning. You know, it's a selfish fulfillment, because when somebody smiles when you walk in the room, or they're comforted by your presence, it's powerful. And, you know, it's definitely become something that you love to feel.
Yeah, being of service in that way with nothing. I mean, when the expectation of return is that maybe you get a smile, or I mean, it's so simple. It's so human. It's just a sort of fundamental human connection.
I remember one time they were shooting Nothing in Common with Tom Hanks and Jackie Gleason at the hospital. My patient's like, "Oh gosh, you have to go get pictures. You know, you have to go down there." So I ran down on my break and saw Jackie Gleason. He was in the wheelchair. And this is the scene where Tom Hanks is going to push him down this hallway in the wheelchair. And I walk over to Jackie Gleason. Well, he actually saw me, and I was standing there in a lab coat, and he went like this, because I was standing kind of near his eyeline, but I didn't know what an eyeline was. I didn't know what my face was. I just saw a camera and lights and a movie. And I was like, oh, I get to see how a movie's made. And he said, are you in this scene? And I said, no, I'm a nurse. But I'm an actor too. I remember this conversation with Jakey Gleaser. I'm like, I'm at Second City at night. And he said, and I think we were dark on Mondays. And he said, well, I'm going to be at the Maroon Raccoon, this jazz club. And I said, yeah, I know it. And you know, Jackie Gleason was everything. He was the Honeymooners, you know, he was the Jackie Gleason show. And he was just so amazing. And he's the great one. And he loved music and arranged music without even reading it, you know. And so I went to see him at that club that night. And it was a big deal. So when I was telling my patients about it, one of my patients said, did you meet Tom Hanks? I'm like, no, the guy from Bosom Buddies. No, I said, I saw him. I said, I already felt bad enough that I had walked like into the bubble of where they were shooting. And I like got back to the floor and told them the whole story. And one of my patients, oh, someday you'll, you know, do a movie with Tom Hanks. And then, you know, I ended up playing Tom's wife in The Green Mile, you know, all those years later. And so
full circle. Crazy. Yeah.
You know, we don't know about our path or why we're nudged in certain directions in life. But sometimes, you know, you look back and you go, oh, wow, that's pretty cool.
Well, and for you, it so many, it was the your patients giving you this sort of courage and giving you this sort of big life advice.
My mom was a life advice person. You know, she was always giving us this gold, like this. She was always kind and funny, but had expectations of us and, you know, rules and all that stuff. But she'd always say to me, and especially when I was writing this last series I did for Apple, Amber Brown, she said, always remember Bonnie, the ripple effect. You know, everything you put out into the universe has a ripple effect. So be mindful of that. So I've always kind of carried that with me. And sometimes, you know, you just go, oh, so I worry so much about that all the time. But it does make a difference. And it kind of gives you these bumpers on either side of you that keep you on a night. It's been nice. I've been very lucky and been able to be a storyteller from my heart. And it's so fulfilling when you connect with people. And it's not about the success. You know, I write for connection, and it's always served me well.
Yeah, that's a powerful message, though. What you put out in the world comes back to you. I always talk to my kids about that. Even if it's, you know, if you smile and say good morning to someone, it's a ripple effect, right? Or if you slam your horn and curse at somebody, it's a ripple effect. And you have no idea how far that goes.
Right.
Yeah. And I think too, like our son is a really sensitive kid, and he's a teenage boy, you know, and he's got this really sensitive side, and it's a really interesting, because he loves to put out, he's like, oh no, I got such a funny, like he'll tell me a story about getting into the elevator with it. Now as seniors, they're allowed to ride the elevator. And that's the big sort of thing the seniors get to do. The 1 year they get to ride the elevator, but he's like, but the other thing is the teachers are in the elevator sometimes. So it's not that great because you have to kind of socialize with the teachers, but he will come back and tell me a story about, you know, making a teacher laugh or something. And he's not like a clown or a jokester in that way, but he'll crack a joke and he'll just say, oh, I could tell I got a really good laugh. Like that just made me feel so good. And it's just that. But on the flip side of it, he'll say, yeah, I said hi to so-and-so and they just kind of shrugged it off. And he's so, you know, he's so sensitive about it. So I do think that it's always, if you know your intention is putting it out there so that, you know, it comes back to you.
That energy does come back to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you do it with sincerity and you keep a sense of humor about the days when you don't have the goodness. You know, it's like there's days where you just go, oh, was I kind of a jerk today or whatever.
Right. But at least you're mindful of it. Right. Some people don't even give it a thought.
Well, it depends on what family you're from. My family, very quick to tell you. Right. You know, true. You know, they bring you down to earth.
I don't want to skip over anything. And Christine, please take me back if I do. But just the working with Tom Cruise in your first film and then Jerry Maguire, because my gosh, that is one of my all time favorite films and probably most people's. And you were so amazing in it.
Oh, thanks.
Did you guys know each other through those years or did it was like a reconnect?
No, we did. I mean, that was my That's the movie I got on my lunch hour at the hospital.
I love that you said
all these pictures next to their beds of me and Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman. You know, I put them in little frames and it was such a big deal.
Wait, what was that first, before you even get into that too, you say that you got it at your lunch hour and it was a cattle call. Were they putting you on tape? Was Barry Levinson in town? How did that work?
No, it wasn't. Barry wasn't there, but he was looking at tapes. But I remember I didn't know what auditions were. I mean, I was auditioning constantly. I never, till this day, I don't think I've ever gotten a part based on an audition except Rain Man. All the other movies were, it was never because of an audition. I'm a terrible auditioner. I'm terrible. And I love to act. I love to be the ball. Put me in the scene. No problem. You don't want you to see any seams. Just let me be the person. But when it comes to auditioning, there's something so insincere about it that I want to start laughing. I want to go, this is ridiculous.
It's almost its own skill set, right? It has nothing. It almost has nothing to do with the job. It has nothing. It's just about being able to, in this sort of small bubble, create something that's completely manufactured, right?
And the pantomime. I mean, I'm driving.
Running. And how do you stand out? But yeah, okay. So you had no idea what an audition even was.
And when you say it has nothing to do with the part, till this day, as a director or executive producer, I never audition anybody. I just meet with actors. Can't do it to them.
God bless you.
Seriously.
And sometimes they're like, please let me read. And then I'll say, okay. But for the most part, I'm like, just don't, because I can't do it. Yeah, I went in and I remember there was a box of Kleenexes like on the side table. So right before they put the tape on to run the tape for me to do like two lines, I grabbed a Kleenex out of the box and put it on my head so it looked like a waitress's cap.
Like a cap?
So ridiculous.
Wait, you played the waitress where the toothpicks
I dropped the toothpicks, yeah.
And oh my God. I mean, he knows how many toothpicks are on the board. That is such a powerful scene.
And they kept showing it on the Academy Awards that year. It was like,
oh my gosh,
that clip they kept showing. And I was like, I've made it to the Academy Awards. I'm done. I've got my videotape for the nursing home for myself. My children, my grandkids, which I've never had. I had all these big plans for that one little part that I had. I just figured that was it. That was all I would ever do.
And Tom Cruise figures out that he's missing a few, that he's off. And you say there's four left in the box.
The only scene written at the time, because it was I think it was at the end of the writer's strike when we were filming, and the only scene was that he recognizes my name tag and knows the phone number. So Tom Cruise has realized, how did my brother memorize a phone book? But at some point, Barry Levinson's like, I don't know if that's enough for the audience to really get that he has this ability to count. And you know, this the blessings of autism, where you have this really special skill. And so on the set, it was like, you know, you could drop something. And then it just became dropping the toothpicks. And
so that was just on the fly.
I don't know if it was in a prior version of the draft, because it was a very, you know, it was the writer's strike. So nobody was writing.
Right.
It was like a thought. And yeah, it was great.
So you get into that scene and as the first bit, I mean, you've been doing Second City with extremely talented people, but these are full fledged movie stars.
And I don't know that the scene is just Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise till I get there.
Oh, no.
No.
You guys. And then Barry Levinson says, we do one take. And he says, hold on. He goes, you got to hit your mark. And I said, you know, of course. And I didn't know what a mark was. So I walked back in again and he yells cut. He goes, hit your mark. And I said, okay. And I walked back and I'm literally feel like I'm going to faint. I'm like, what's a mark? I don't know what a mark is. And I thought, on your mark, get set, go. He means when he says action, you run in.
Oh, on your mark, get set.
No.
That's all I could think of. That and jump rope, you know, analogies. I didn't know. I was just like, you know, jump in. So he says action and I run and he goes, cut. He goes, what are you, what's the hurry? I go, I'm gonna hit my mark. You know, I'm trying to get the lingo down. And he goes, let's go again. And he's thinking, what the heck? And I walk back and there's a guy, people smoked on the set. He's like sitting on an apple box that's on its side. Some crew guy, God bless him. And I looked at him and I go, excuse me, sir. He goes, yeah. I go, what's hit mark mean? What does it mean? And he goes, piece of tape. See that piece of tape? I said, you go step on it.
That's how you learn.
Oh my God. I made love to that man after that day of shooting. I was like, so grateful. And then
that story is incredible. I mean,
I was running past the camera. I was probably, my head was cut off. I mean, it was just, and every time I see Barry Levinson, well, just love him so much. I mean, he got me into the union and gave me that sweet role.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us. They burned us and subject us to really horrible, cruel and unusual punishment.
After my personal experience at Provo Canyon School, I was shocked to learn that a man named Robert Litchfield, a man who got his start at the school that I went to, would go on to create a multi-million dollar empire.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
The Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They prey on, you know, a parent's really natural and beautiful love for their children in a really, really, unfortunately, effective way.
At this time in my life now, if someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, sham, scam, beware.
Listen to Season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s.
She looked like a million bucks.
With zero qualifications.
She had a Harvard plaque.
Tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. That this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6
million? Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so you have your day. I assume it was a day. of on Rain Man?
Yeah, I think it was 2 days. Yes.
2 days. Sunday.
I don't remember. It just, I was there. I was in Cincinnati for three days.
If the movie comes out, you're all over the Oscars. You've made it. That's it.
That's it. I'm happy.
And so what came next? And to David's question too, with Jerry Maguire, since this was not Tom Cruise calling you and saying, I want you to be in Jerry Maguire. Was that another audition? Was that, well, you said that you didn't audition. Was that you talking to Cameron?
I think it was Robin Williams was Jerry Maguire then. Tom Hanks was Jerry Maguire for a while.
Robin Williams?
I had no idea.
Jerry Maguire?
I'm pretty sure if my memory serves me. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And and then when it was Tom Cruise, I remember Cameron, I went in, and you know who was the reader for all the Tom Cruise dialogue off camera when people were coming in to read an audition was Owen Wilson.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah. No.
Gig. Yeah.
That is such a fun fact. That why is that not circulated more? I have never heard that story. In
working with Jim Brooks because you're doing Bottle Rocket or something,
and right.
So producing Jerry Maguire. But yeah, so anyway, I ended up. I think when Cameron said, "You know, would you play the sister?" which was a pretty small role in the script, and I think a couple of actresses had turned it down, thinking it was too small of a role. And I was pretty heartbroken about thinking that maybe I would finally be the lead girl. But I loved the story. So I said, well, yeah, I love the story. I want to be a part of it. And then when we're shooting the film, it was like, do you want to be in the kitchen scene tomorrow? Why don't you, a lot of stuff was improvised. There's scenes where I'm looking out the window and she's getting in the car. We all did that afterwards. I was like, yeah, I can just, you know, they would just roll and I would do what Cameron was kind enough to let me do. So there's a lot of improvisation in that movie. Like, at the end of the day, don't cry at the beginning of the day, cry at the end, like I do.
Gosh. The classics.
Yeah. And the sister relationship. It was a major part of the movie, how you cared for each other, you know?
Yeah, but you have to have that gift of the director, writer-director who gives you a take. You know, I always do as scripted, of course, but then I'll say, they'll say, you want one? I'm like, yeah.
And then that's so great.
The movie, you're so thrilled.
Yeah, you are so special in that movie. I mean, of course, Jerry Maguire's Renee and Tom, but there's no Jerry Maguire to me without you in that film. Like that, you are the heart and soul of that film and the anchor of, you know, of her. The family that cares about her, that doesn't want her
to call me an anchor.
Stop. So that sounds like that was such a fulfilling experience and that you really got to play. You have a lot of sort of like classic classics that throughout the 90s and the 2000s.
Beethoven was, I was 29 and Charles Grodin was 58.
Oh.
And you were married. That's funny.
Yes. And the girl that played my daughter, I would have had her when I was like 14. but it was Charles Grodin. You know, it was meeting Charles Grodin. And
the greatest.
I was supposed to play the Patricia Heaton role, which Patricia Heaton and David Duchovny were the annoying yuppie couple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the role that they originally hired me for. And then I said something to Ivan Reitman in one of the meetings, like, oh, you should, you know, you might want to make the mom a little smarter. And he's like, excuse me? I'm like, oh, you know, I have some ideas if you want them, you know. And so they brought me in and I was writing with this other writer who I saw years later at a dinner party. He said, boy, that was the fastest 500 grand I ever made. And I thought, I wasn't paying anything. I was just coming in, you know, I was thrilled to be included to see the process. But then I started improvising with Charles Grodin just to practice some work on some scenes that they were rewriting. And that's when Ivan Reitman's like, you know, maybe she should be the mom. And I was like, I can't be the mom. My mom and dad came home from the heartbreak kid when I was, 9 or 10. And I remember them talking about Charles Grodin. I can't be his wife. Yeah.
But the funny wins out, right? People will suspend the disbelief of the age if it's working comedically and story-wise, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think maybe it was, you know, Ivan's way of pay me for, you know, bringing material into the film. I don't know. It was just so nice. And Charles Grodin was a friend and hilarious and funny. And I had sold my first sitcom shortly after that. And he would come to the tapings and be kind of in the background in the shadow, and then would call me afterwards to tell me what he thought was worked and what didn't. And he really believed in me. And I still have notes that he wrote me. Just there was so much respect. And, you know, that was huge for me. That's huge when people believe in you. You never forget the kindness. There's so many hard moments in show business where you feel so rejected and misunderstood and frustrated and cheated out of stuff. But then, you know, it's so far outweighed by this kindness that comes along. And so that was a big deal. That was, and only you, when I got to go to Italy, because remember Norman Jewison saying to me, "You know how Italy is." I said, "Italy? I've only been to Wisconsin." I mean, I had never traveled anywhere. So that was huge.
Yeah, the opportunities.
Junior and Marissa Tomei and I in Italy for 4 months, you know.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That's like dream job. Ben jokes that, you know, when his mom, he tells a story about wanting to go like backpacking after, you know, did UCLA for almost a year and then wanted to just come and like make films. But he was like, "I think I'm going to go backpacking." And he tells this famous story of Ann Mira, his mom saying, get cast in something in Europe. Why go backpacking? Get a job. That's the way to do it.
Of course, she's a genius, was a genius. And that is so true, because I never saw Europe the same again if I weren't. I mean, when I wrote and directed Return to Me, this movie I did in Chicago and Italy with David Duchovny and Minnie Driver, I wrote the scenes in Italy on purpose because I said, I have to go back with the movie because it was the best experience.
Of course, you have to do it that way, right? You get too spoiled.
And you think about Ben doing that variety show, like that was all, I just remember I met Ben in Chicago when I was at Second City and thought he was funny and charming, had no idea who his folks were. And of course, grew up loving them, respecting them. You know, they were in Chicago too, in the 50s and late 60s. And Ben was at the forefront. Remember that show?
The Ben Stiller show. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, come on. And he used to do videos all the time. He and Jeff Kahn, they would do these videos that we would just watch. They were like,
exactly. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think also Chicago was where he started, where he made Elvis Stories, which was one of the first videos that sort of helped launch the Ben Stiller show. But he talks about that whole Chicago crew and
he did it.
Oh, it's such a small world. So after, was it, at what point did everything shift for you and was it Jerry Maguire where then you just started sort of getting offered things or you started sort of like saying, I'm going to write my own stuff now? And because
I'm still waiting for that to happen.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
But really, truly, there's those moments where you sort of, hey, this is the, and then just opportunities change and shift. And that was a period of time in movies. Like I'm looking at where you were in sort of hit after hit. And by the way, we haven't even gotten to your voiceover work. Like you were the voice in our household in Cars, Sally. I've heard all of the Pixar movies. It was just sort of nonstop work.
Yeah, I think when I started writing for myself was after I did a series. I did a series called Grand with Michael McKean and Pamela Reed. This was NBC. It was Carsey Werner. They had Cosby on the air, Roseanne. And it was a really funny show. When I went into audition, the script wasn't completed, but they told me about the characters. And they said, we don't have an actual scene for your character. We have these other characters. And I said, well, the character you described to me, I can play her in a scene with the other characters. And they said, well, those actors aren't here. I said, well, I could do all three characters if you give me three chairs. but I believe me, if they had scripted material and I auditioned, they never would hire me because I'm so bad at auditioning. So they put three folding chairs in this little office at Bradford. And I kept moving from chair to chair, and I did the scene between these three main characters on the series. And that's how I got that job. So I was really lucky. But then when that show was going to be canceled, there was a show called Davis Rules with Jonathan Winters and Randy Quaid. And then there was Designing Women, and Delta Burke was leaving. So Designing Women comes to me and offers me Designing Women at more money than I made in a year as a nurse I would make in 1 week.
Oh my gosh.
And, but the show, it wasn't the same as, and I got an offer for half that amount of money to be with Jonathan Winters and Audrey Meadows as my parents on the show Davis Rules. And my agent actually, I'm pretty sure that's when they dropped me, when I turned down the Designing Women, because Designing Women offered me the cover. I'd be on the cover of TV Guide. I would be able to go to the Emmys and present at the Emmys. And, you know, I hadn't done anything except this one little show, but it just wasn't my, I enjoyed Designing Women. I was a fan, but I just saw Jonathan Winters and Audrey Meadows. I have to do that show. And I'm so glad I did. I'm so glad I did. And it was a big deal at the time that I said no to Designing Women. And yeah, people were very disappointed in me. And then I remember feeling really sad, like I had made a horrible mistake. But Jonathan Winters and Audrey Meadows, my friends till the day they died, guidance, support, love, humor, brilliance. You know, Audrey saying after a taping, let's go out for a highball. You know, she wanted to go out for an old fashioned or a Manhattan, or she always wanted her drink.
Audrey Meadows, coming back to the Jackie Gleason beginning.
That takes a lot of guts to turn down that kind of money
and the promise to be an Emmy presenter and TV Guide cover.
And the lead, you know what I mean? Filling the shoes. I mean, I think that's the other thing too, is you sort of knowing deep down inside, like design, like this Delta Burke, that was sort of her, she created that. So how do I step into this and make it?
The other thing was, the offer at Carsey Warner was they offered me the Jonathan Winters, this show, because Jonathan was not sticking to the script and it was making the tapings go longer and longer. So they said, we would like to hire you for this purpose. And I said, what's the purpose? They go, when we're going to put you in scenes with Jonathan, and when he goes off script, you improvise and bring him back to the story.
Wow.
I mean, that's
right in my wheelhouse.
Yes. I'm like, so it, yeah, that was, and it was, and he loved me for it. And I loved him because I got to bring my own personality, my version of this character. She was kind of like, she was tough broad, compared to what I played on Grand, which was this wealthy, very feminine, sweet lady. But it was a joy, and it was a challenge. It was a challenge every taping, and I loved it. I mean, he would throw that ball in the air, and you know, he would go off on a tangent, and I was able
just
to
starting to juggle. You just had to juggle it.
And your Second City training,
the best,
it served you well. Yeah,
yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Second City training, it trained you for everything. I mean, when I first got out of nursing school, I worked 2 years in a trauma center, and as a nurse, and you know, I just remember taking those classes at night at Viola Spolin workshop. It was her studio. She wasn't there. I think she was long gone at that time, not teaching anymore. But yeah, it makes you think fast on your feet. It helps you and everything.
And then so you know, this was all 90s, and then you go into the 2000s and Cheaper by the Dozen, and that, you know, working with. I mean, I look at the people you've worked with. I mean, comedy legends. I mean, the
I've been so lucky. Tom Hanks, Robin Williams, Steve Martin, Dan Aykroyd.
Not to mention the directors.
Who?
The directors that you.
Oh, gosh. I mean. Sidney Pollack, you know. I remember him grabbing me by the shoulders when I thought I was having a bad day. And he's like, no, Bonnie, on your worst day, it's not a bad day. And I played that over my head for so long when I felt so down, because I kept losing, I just kept not getting parts. I just was a terrible auditioner. But then I would be so lucky to, like somebody like Sidney Pollack, to believe in me and let me be on the set with him. And
what movie was that he directed?
Random Hearts, Harrison Ford, Christine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Thomas. Oh my gosh. One of the greatest. Yeah. And a great actor too.
Oh, but he was everything that I strived for. Because he would fix it in the moment, run it on the fly. always appreciate your humor. I remember there's one scene where I was supposed to be crying and I'm upset and I get myself to tears and I'm doing the scene and we're shooting in New York in a restaurant and a semi went by and it was like, this loud horn. And I said, there's my ride. And I got up and walked out of the scene. And
that's great.
The whole end of the take. But Sydney would play it on the set, you know, the video playback just to laugh. He's like, I can't believe you just did that. But you know.
And those are the directors you said you love when they let you play a little bit.
Right. That's what you were your best. Of course, you respect the material and you do it as written because I'm a writer and I never want to let a writer down either, you know. But it's really fun when you can explore and heighten a character. And when I did my first show, Christine, after I did Davis Rules, and the frustrating thing was watching Davis Rules and seeing Jonathan Winters improvise comedy gold. And then you'd see the show air and I would see half the stuff was edited out.
Ugh.
And it would break my heart. So then I started to see there's this balance between scripted material, all of a sudden not looking as shiny and as bright compared to this man's mind. So they couldn't balance it. So I thought, okay, I got to write a show where I hire actors from Second City and I script the show, but they have freedom. And we go through the show straight, no retakes, and the audience is there in real time. And I choreograph it so that the audience comes in and we're done in an hour. And that's when I wrote and produced The Building, which I wrote the show, sold the show to CBS, got a 13-episode commitment, shot the pilot. And then they said, well, you have to get somebody to produce the show with you. I said, well, I just did it. I just did the whole thing. And that's when I sent the tape to Letterman and said, you know, he goes, well, I don't know. I don't know how to produce it. I don't know what to do. I'll put my name on it. I love it. I think it's great. And I said, yeah, that's all you need to do. Put your name on it. And then I need to go back to CBS and say, I got a partner. And he's like, okay, fine.
Had you done Letterman a bunch of times? And were you okay. So you were friendly and he's still the best of the best in that world. He was my all time favorite.
Everyone. But just him putting his name on it allowed you to just do the show that you were doing anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the show was already sold. It was already in place that I would do these 13 episodes, but they wanted me to have a producing partner. At the time, I was the first, not only the first woman, but the first person, which Bob Wright, who worked at CBS, told me, nobody has ever done this. And he said, that's why they're having a hard time with it. I said, done what? He said, nobody's ever written and starred in their own television series. It's never happened. I said, well, Carl Reiner did it. The Dick Van Dyke show. He goes, no, Carl Reiner wrote himself as the lead. They shot the pilot with him as a lead. And they said, no, you can't do both. So they hired Dick Van Dyke, reshot the pilot, and Carl played an ancillary character. And so he said, you can't do this. So then I had to go to the Directors Guild and a big meeting and they were all around this table and I had to tell them how I could do it. And then I just said, I ran an emergency room, you know, I can run a set. And then I used Sidney Pollack as an example that he was writing and directing and being in scenes. And so finally they let me do it, but I was the first person to do that, but I had no clue that I was. And then that's when it became a big deal. And I had to go to all the unions and explain how I was going to pull this off. And then eventually with Life with Bonnie, I was able to write 44 episodes and direct 43.
Oh my gosh.
Wait, you wrote, directed and starred in Life with Bonnie?
Yes.
That's unreal. That's a lot of work.
Don Lake and I wrote together the series and I executive produced and directed. I directed 43 of the 44 episodes. And we were nominated for Emmys and we had so much fun. It's just, we did great shows. I'm so proud of all of our work because it was always the team. It was the team. Everybody brought their best. I would always ask my crew, is this funny? And the camera guy, I think it's funny if she does this. I'm like, that's perfect. You know, our set was open and the crew was a part of it. The energy of the crew is everything.
Well, that is always your best audience. I mean, that's when you know you're reaching, especially when they're there for hour after and you're still getting the laughs and then you know you're doing something right. And for you, like, you're so egoless. I mean, that's what's so amazing. I think it's just sort of.
People would say I wanted to be in control. I was always, she wants to be in control. She wants to do everything. She wants to do craft service. She wants to write and direct and act. I wanted to see my shows all the way through because I wanted to allow the freedom on the set.
Right. You
know, where there's talent, there's not that fear. And when there's that fear and control, there's usually questionable ability because you're afraid of it. And
right. And also to know, you know, just from personal experience of seeing what they did with Jonathan, is that you know that by having this control, that it will be the golds, the gems, all of those things are not going to get edited out. That's where all the good stuff is. And that's going to get to stay in the finished product.
When Davis Rules, which was a show I did with Audrey Meadows and Jonathan Winters, when that was canceled, I remember thinking, oh, if I could just go into that editing room, if I could just go in there and there was so much gold. Jonathan was hilarious. The audience, and then they stopped laughing, basically, when we would go back to the script. Not that the scripted material wasn't good. It was of quality. But right. In comparison to the potentially nominated, go ahead. He was nominated for an Emmy for Life with Bonnie, Jonathan. I brought him on and I wrote nothing except came up with like five different books by different authors. And we gave him the role of an author with multiple personality disorder. So he had five books out under five different names, but he didn't know the books until he came out and sat down. And I would hand him a book. I go, tell us about this one. And the whole scene is improvised from start to finish. And Jonathan was nominated for an Emmy and he was
genius.
And he was so happy. He was so happy because it was many years later that I did that series and able to bring it back. But David, I cut you off.
No, that's fascinating. So many comedians say that Jonathan Winters was their inspiration and one of the greats. But I love that, you know, maybe the writers were precious or maybe they were threatened that they weren't writing material at the level that he's performing. And then you said on your show, if a grip gave you an idea, you took it. And I love that.
And I'd also put the crew in the show. Like if somebody was really funny on the crew, I'm like, I gotta write this guy in. It was so fun. So, and the same thing with my talk show, you know, I was including the crew all the time and I was always getting called by the studio saying, stop talking to the cameraman, stop, you know, and so the audience likes him, you know.
We don't want to ruin the illusion that there's anybody behind the scenes.
No, but that's good stuff.
It's the best.
Yeah, it is. It's so fun. So fun.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women. And this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s.
She looked like a million bucks.
With zero qualifications.
She had a Harvard plaque.
Tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. That this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6
million? Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So today, because you do it all, I mean, you literally do it all, and you remind me, and I'm going to say it, and this is probably why I love you so much, is you remind me so much of Ben. Like, you do it all, and you do it all so beautifully. And so what is next? Because do you want to direct more? Do you, you know, I know you don't want to audition, and I'm with you there.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't mind. I'll go into any meeting. And if somebody really wants to see me read a scene, I'm happy to do it. I don't say I won't do that. I've never said that. I'm kind of like, oh, yeah, I'm lucky if somebody is even interested in me. That's how I still feel always. I always feel that way.
Yeah.
Do I wish I got some of the roles that I see other women getting till this day? Yeah, it's still kind of, you know, twinges your heart a little
bit. They sting. It stings.
Yeah. I mean, Christine, you get it.
I so get it.
That's what we talked about that night. Like, I would hire you in a New York minute. It was so, that's why when I sit next to you, I'm like, oh, I hope I can call Christine and say, here, do this, because you're so talented. But it's easy to get lost in the shuffle. For me, I love being a storyteller, and I love being part of good stories. That's what I look forward to. But I don't know what's next. I took a lot of time off after my talk show because I had a brother-in-law who had gotten a brain tumor during that show. And so I moved in with my sister and my brother-in-law to be his full-time caregiver through his journey back to mostly his former self. And we're blessed that he's a survivor, but it takes years. So yeah. Years went by and I was home in Chicago. And it's good because it's always a gift. It's always a gift when people let you in and you can care for them. So at that time off, I remember, and then somebody else in my family got sick and I was like, what do I do? And then I just said to my agent, oh, I can't do anything right now. And then I didn't keep saying somebody was sick. I just kind of said no to stuff. And then I thought, are they mad at me? Because I'm saying no, but I don't want to not be available. So I don't want to say somebody's sick because I'm afraid they won't call me anymore. All the stuff that actors go through,
Sure.
You want to be a team player. You want to cooperate, but you want to have some control. And I was listening to one of your shows. I listened to one of your shows and he was on Scandal and he had to do some scene. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Oh, Dan Bukatinsky. Yes.
And Dan said, it was really hard for me. I want an actor on my set to say, and I even on my talk show, when people leave the show, because we were live to tape, I'd say, I have a couple minutes if there's something you want me to take out, or, I just wanted people to leave feeling okay and good.
Safe, protected.
Yes, because you can still, when you are at the very top of your game and you are respectful and you are truly funny without shocking, embarrassing someone else, at the mercy of someone else, at the deprecation of someone else, that's when I feel it's true genius. That's when I go, oh man, that is good. And so I just that I want that comfort on a set too, that I can say, that doesn't feel quite right to me. My first sitcom, I remember they wrote this joke and I'm like, I can't do it. I can't do the joke. And I remember
we've all been
Michael
there,
McKeon
yeah.
was in the scene with me. He's like, don't say anything. They can hear you. And I didn't know that the boom mic went into the slide. You guys, I didn't know anything. I didn't. I had no training. I had no, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, this, they, how long did it take me to write this joke? It's so disgusting. I said, it's not even funny. It's just icky. It's not funny. It's icky.
And the writers are all listening. Oh yeah.
Yeah. They're all listening to me.
Embarrassing.
And all of a sudden they all converge down. They, you know, they want to talk to me. And I'm like, oh. I felt so, and I felt badly for the writer because I didn't want him to get in trouble, but he wasn't. They were like, you know, you're doing the joke. And I said, I can't.
You got to shut those mics at lunch, man. And when you go to the bathroom.
Did you know that, David? Did you guys know that on your shows? Like when you were on Blossom and, you know.
Well, Christine and I did a show together and I don't know if, I think they heard a lot of stuff.
That's when we first learned it. I remember everyone saying, you got to start to turn that off or unplug it or, you know, and it's, you know, it's crazy to me that, that's still a thing. Oh, Bonnie, we have to wrap. I can't believe this. We've kept you for a full hour. This
I feel like I wanted to ask you guys so many questions, and all I did was talk.
No, that's what you're here for.
Wait, can we just ask about this? Despite your taking time off and you're saying, are people mad at you? You're in a movie coming out with one of the biggest movie stars on the planet right now, The Rock. Is that true?
Yeah.
What, tell us about that real quick.
Christmas, the red one. J.K. Simmons and I play Mr. and Mrs. Claus. And Chris Evans and The Rock are, it's,
oh my goodness.
It was quite a journey.
We've got a good new Christmas movie coming. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah. And I'm doing Bonnie's a film back. Now with Allison Janney, that Jim Rash wrote. I'll be doing that in New Mexico. But no, I didn't think anybody was mad at me. I just thought the agents were disappointed.
Right. No, I know.
She thinks she is turning all this stuff down. But you know, fine line we walk between.
We really do. People pleasing and having agency, right? Yeah. Oh, Bonnie, this was so terrific. Also, I have to say, Ella, our daughter.
Oh, your daughter.
Madly in love with you. I think whenever you're in New York or we're in LA, let's please get together. I would love for us all to, you know, give each other hugs because I just love you so much. And thank you so much for doing this.
You're the best. And David, you're welcome to join us, please.
Yes.
Anytime. This is so much fun. It was such a pleasure to get to know you.
So nice meeting you, honey.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Thanks, Bonnie. I love her. She is isn't her story incredible?
Her story is incredible, and she's such an amazing person. Like the way that she started helping people in a hospital, she would bring the Second City troop into the cancer unit. I mean, that's just, I love her. I mean, inspirational.
I mean, literally, like I said, those events, you can get seated at a table where it's like just pure, like I'm anxious and sweating the whole time. But right. I was sitting right next to Bonnie and her beautiful niece. And we had like, it was from minute one, just bonding over family and all of it. And she, it just like, to me, she is just, there is a calling there. You heard her talking just about even helping her brother-in-law with a brain, like she shows up and she is just such a caregiver first and foremost, but she is also that in her work. She cares about everybody around her. And she's just amazing.
It comes back to what she said about you get back from the world, what you put out into the world. And that's why you look at the people she's worked with. I mean, that's not normal. It's the actors and the directors that she's over the years. It's insane. Legends. But she's put all this positivity out in the world and it's come back to her and she deserves it. She's so talented.
And how she really talks about there's a lot of heartbreak and a lot of disappointment and a lot of rejection in this business. Yeah. But when the person like a Sydney Pollack who says to you, you know what, this really isn't the worst day. Like this is actually, it's a pretty good life. Like you have one person tell you how good it is and how much they appreciate you. That's all that matters. Like, that is all that matters because you got to let the rest go.
So true. A lot of gratitude. She has a lot of gratitude now after all of it.
Oh, man, is she funny. And she's also just such a great dramatic actress, too. Like, we didn't even get to that because we were talking about
her. You know what? I wanted to say to her because she did talk about her Second City training has served her throughout her entire career. But like, I've always thought, if you are a great improv comedic actor, doing a dramatic scene is like a walk in the park, because you've seen amazing comedic actors like Jim Carrey or Tom Hanks, who started in comedies, and they go to do the most amazing drama, but you don't necessarily see a dramatic actor crushing a comedy. That's
exactly. It's so true. It can really fall flat. You're so right. You're so right. But she just really does it all. I mean, and really does it all. Like, I would like to be Bonnie Hunt when I grow up, even though we're only like a few years apart.
You can play her.
I would love to. She said that to me. She's like, I would hire you in a New York minute. I'm like, okay, let's go. Let's do it. Let's find something.
Any casting director would say, oh yeah, that makes total sense.
Oh gosh. All right. Well, that was a great, great,
Thanks,
chat.
Christine. That was awesome.
And, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you all, back here next week.
Yep. Have a great week, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to subscribe and give us 5 stars.
And please follow us on Instagram at Hey Dude, the 90s called. See you next time.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like $1 million,
scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us.
He was trying to brand us. So we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
Join my host as they unravel the story of the largest and most shocking organization in the history of the troubled teen industry. Listen to Season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.